Texas discriminates against minority voters. That's what a panel of judges said this week as they ruled that the state's controversial voter ID law violates the U.S. Voting Rights Act. I'm Shelley Koffler, and this is Fronteras, a public radio program about issues along the Texas-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. The current voter ID law in Texas has been in the courts ever since state lawmakers passed it 4 years ago. It requires voters to show an approved photo ID when they go to the polls. While the judges found that the voter ID law discriminates, they left it in place until there's more legal review. Texas Public Radio's Ryan Poppy reports on this latest ruling in a case that's had many twists and turns.
Texas voter ID law passed in 2011 has sometimes been called the toughest of its kind in the country. It requires a voter show approved photo identification before being allowed to cast a ballot. In their ruling, the judges from the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals agreed with the U.S. District Judge Nelva Gonzalez-Ramos when she found the law racially discriminatory because Texans without approved ID tended to be minorities. Voting rights experts have said that the process for gaining state-issued free IDs can be prohibitively costly because citizens must provide their birth certificates and purchasing them can be expensive. State Representative Trey Martinez-Fisher, a Democrat from San Antonio, says the ruling is especially significant for blacks and Hispanics living in Texas.
This case, if you read the opinion, has some very clear language that says people in Texas should be able to vote with their voter certificates, in other words, with their voter registration cards that we've been using for years.
While the panel of judges said that the sections of Texas's law violates federal law, they said that the authors didn't necessarily intend to discriminate against specific groups. Martinez-Fisher, a plaintiff in the case, says proving intent can be extremely difficult.
I think that in this day and age, to find discriminatory intent, I mean, you're literally asking to find a smoking gun. In other words, if the Secretary of State's office had notified the Attorney General or the legislature that this was going to be a problem for minority voters and they move forward anyway, knowing that would be discriminatory purpose.
And the lack of proof that there was intent to discriminate is one of the reasons the case is being sent back to Judge Ramos in Corpus Christi for further examination of the evidence. Martinez-Fisher says if Judge Ramos throws out voter ID, it would take a vote of the legislature to restore it. Governor Greg Abbott, who defended the voter ID law as Attorney General, reacted to the Fifth Circuit ruling, saying, in light of ongoing voter fraud, it is imperative that Texas has a voter ID law that prevents cheating at the ballot box. Abbott says the state will continue its fight to keep the law in place. Texas has held three elections where voters have had to show valid photo IDs. Even though another court review will take place, the photo ID requirement remains in place for Texans.
That's Texas Public Radio's Ryan Poppy reporting. Policies being adopted to curb global warming may also be headed to court. This past week, President Obama called for deeper cuts in carbon dioxide emissions at power plants. Some energy companies and top Texas officials reacted by promising to sue the federal government. They want to block the president's plan. They say the cuts will financially damage businesses. The policy clash comes as San Antonio's Henry Cisneros and other national business leaders are highlighting research that warns the cost to the economy will be much greater if harmful emissions are not controlled now. So, this is a story about business people using business principles to convince other CEOs and companies to spend a little now on prevention. The list of business leaders behind the research project entitled Risky Business includes some heavy hitters who know more than just a little about the corporate bottom line. They include President George W. Bush's U.S. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, and billionaire hedge fund manager Tom Steyer. Working with them, a bipartisan committee that includes many former presidential cabinet members, including San Antonio's Henry Cisneros, who served as U.S. Housing Secretary. Cisneros says that what the data shows about the effects of unchecked greenhouse gas emissions on Texas is frightening.
That report says Texas is indeed a very vulnerable part of the United States to climate change.
The report says Texas's already hot summers are on track to get hotter and longer. The average 43 days a year we now have with temperatures above 95 degrees will nearly double in the next two decades to 80 days above 95 degrees. And somewhere around 2059, Texans could be living with that much heat 106 days each year.
Now we're talking about a third of the year over 95 degree temperatures, right? That changes crop patterns. That changes jobs in agriculture. It changes the productivity of work in construction, on rooftops. You can't work in the middle of the day. You have to change the work hours. The drought implications, of course, are immense. More costs for getting water, less ability to build because there will be no water permits for growth areas.
Homes and businesses would need more air conditioning, so more power would have to be generated. Then there's the effect of rising temperatures on the Gulf Coast. The research concludes that among all U.S. cities, climate trends pose the biggest threat to New Orleans and Houston.
And the Houston Ship Channel is arguably the place where the greatest expenses can occur to rising sea levels and more violent storms, because the infrastructure of the ship channel is dotted with these massive refineries and shipping facilities.
Cisneros believes that economic projections are so alarming, businesses can be persuaded to first plan for the extra power, water, and necessities that will be needed to create habitable communities. Then, he hopes, CEOs will pull out their calculators.
Begin to get business people also to say, well, if it costs that much, then let's look at the cost of beginning to mitigate the worst of what could happen. Let's figure out how to diminish the curve that otherwise is going to put us in a crisis.
Cisneros believes the breakthrough will come when resistant businesses began to see the reduction of greenhouse emissions not as an environmental or political issue, but as a hard, cold financial calculation. Some scientists believe climate change is part of the reason severe flooding hit Texas this spring. People died, and the price tag for cleanup has topped $27 million. Now the tech community is pitching in with a new internet app that will help victims of natural disasters in the future. Houston Public Media's health and science reporter Carrie Feibel has that story.
Rebecca Silito was one of thousands of Houstonians whose homes were flooded right after Memorial Day. 2 days later, she trudged through her soggy house in rubber boots, logging her losses on a laptop. She says it was difficult to figure out what agencies could help her and how it would all work.
There's so many questions, and like I don't know who to ask some of these questions. So I just wish there was I'm a logical flow person, like who is the person and who can give me a direct yes or no.
In the near future, someone in that situation might simply pull up an application called DART for Disaster Assistance and Recovery Tool. It will guide disaster victims through a questionnaire about their damages and advise them on next steps. Sandra Brown works at Lone Star Legal Aid in Houston.
It gives them quick answers and it's at their fingertips.
Brown is a national legal expert on disaster recovery. She provided the content for the application, and it was put together by tech-oriented law students at Georgetown University. Brown says too many flood victims miss out on grants and loans that could help them rebuild their lives.
A lot of people don't realize that even if you have flood insurance, you should also apply to FEMA. It gives you extra flexibility. And also the Small Business Association. People don't realize that even though it's called the Small Business Association, it gives more disaster funding than any other agency.
The SBA provides low-interest loans. FEMA provides grants. And there are other programs that can kick in later. After completing the app, users will get a personalized report telling them what programs to apply for. It also includes tips and advice.
The big lesson out of Katrina was keep all your receipts. The big lesson after Ike was only use your money for what it's designated for by FEMA. We had a lot of problems with people living off of the money FEMA had given them for their housing repairs.
In Harris County alone, 2,500 homes were affected by the recent floods, plus 3,700 apartments. Francisco Sanchez is a spokesman for the county's Office of Emergency Management. He says the app will be a big help in future floods and hurricanes, even tornadoes and ice storms.
People are expecting information in a digital format if people have evacuated or moved out of their community based on a disaster. That information is now with them in that app.
Brown and the developers are still tweaking the web-based application. It should be ready in October and will be housed on the website disasterlegalaid.org. I'm Carrie Feibel.
Now we go to Dallas, where the dream of home ownership remains elusive for many Americans, including some who have put their lives on the line for their country. But two North Texas nonprofits are coming to the rescue, making home ownership a possibility for some local veterans. KERA's Courtney Collins has the story of how a new house has become a godsend for a 55-year-old and his young daughter, who've known some pretty hard times.
That rhythmic scraping and tapping is the sound of drywall becoming something more, something permanent. As workers smooth over gaps in the sheetrock, Dennis Llewellyn is already admiring how the place looks.
It's not very often we're given a three-bedroom, two-bath brick home with a two-car garage. And this one is in a nice little neighborhood.
On a quiet street a few blocks from South Oak Cliff High School, Llewellyn's nonprofit is working on a project called Homes for Heroes. The group makes over dilapidated homes for veterans. Llewellyn says the project has taken off.
I guess within one calendar year, we'll go from one to doing five is what it looks like.
Remaking a house in the middle of a Texas summer can be brutal. Because it's the future home of former Marine Ben Anderson and his daughter Anasia, nobody seems to mind.
Before we met Ben, he was living in a homeless shelter with his little seven-year-old little girl.
Well, we were staying in the apartment complex. I couldn't let her outside over there. It was too dangerous.
Being homeless isn't the worst of what Anderson survived. In 2011, a work injury left him with a broken back. He hasn't been able to work since. And in the hospital, he found out he had bone cancer. Then, a year later, he lost Anasia's mother and older sister.
Early one morning, got the call that both of them had been killed on 35 in Illinois there.
That drunk driving accident was the low point.
That sucked the life out of me, too, but I knew I had to fight back because of Anasia.
So he did. Anderson fought for custody of his daughter even when they were staying in homeless shelters. He's kept up with his chemo every week at the VA hospital. He can hardly believe that Friday, he'll be a homeowner.
A lot of things I can't do because Daddy can't go outside because of the sun, but with this house, she got a big backyard and a front yard that I can look out the window even on a hot day. And that means the world to me.
Once the sheetrock is up, the kitchen appliances in, and the walls painted, the nonprofit Dwell with Dignity will get to work.
From all of their furniture, draperies, rugs, accessories, to everything they need in their kitchen. So basically this family can walk into their home with a key and they have everything they need to start living their life right now.
Founder Lisa Robison says all too often, families who have finally saved enough for a house or apartment don't have any money left over to buy a sofa or pots and pans. An empty house has an impact.
This doesn't really create an environment where they will celebrate birthdays, for example, or holidays together. A lot of times these kids, they don't want to go home.
Anasia won't feel that way. Her dad knows just how important this home will be.
It means a lot that even when I go, that she will have a house that she can call her own.
She'll turn 8 3 weeks after they move in, and this tidy little ranch house will be birthday party ready. For Fronteras, I'm Courtney Collins.
Just ahead on Fronteras, a group of Navajo young people are on a 6-month pilgrimage, offering prayers for what they consider sacred ground.
And when you're walking out there, you really do see the crazy beautiful out there, you know? The crazy being like the resource extraction, you know, the uranium, the fracking.
That story and how kids are learning the history of Dallas's Little Mexico in summer camp. After this. This is Fronteras, and I'm Shelley Koffler. Here's something you may not know about the recent Supreme Court ruling legalizing same-sex marriage. It does not apply to Native Americans. Only a dozen of the 566 Indian tribes in the U.S. recognize same-sex unions, And the two largest, the Cherokee and the Navajo, have specific laws that forbid marriage between people of the same sex. Lindsay Robertson is director of the Center for the Study of American Indian Law and Policy at the University of Oklahoma. She says the new law cannot be enforced among Native American tribes because they're not parties to the U.S. Constitution. In the West, the territory of the Navajo Nation extends into three states, New Mexico, Arizona, and Utah. It covers more than 27,000 miles. This summer, Navajo youth are walking hundreds of those miles across their reservation on what they call a journey for existence. KUNM's Rita Daniels recently caught up with the walkers in Shiprock in northern New Mexico.
Makai Lewis is from Pinedale, just east of Gallup, and has been walking with the crew through the resource-rich corridor that stretches across Arizona and New Mexico since January.
And when you're walking out there, you really do see the crazy beautiful out there, you know? The crazy being like the resource extraction, you know, the uranium, the fracking, the coal extraction, you know, but at the same time, you know, you still got that beauty there.
His grandfather worked in the uranium mills north of Church Rock in the 1970s and was exposed to high levels of radiation when a wastewater pond burst, which Lewis says led to his early death from cancer. The group is calling on people to pay very close attention to the health and environmental risks associated with resource extraction and power generation. They plan on completing their walk around winter solstice at the end of the year. In Cortez, Colorado, I'm Rita Daniels for Fronteras.
While the young Navajo activists journey to honor the beauty of their land, some kids in Dallas are paying homage to the place where their summer camp is located. KERA Stella Chavez reports the kids are learning about the history of Pike Park, which was once a thriving uptown neighborhood known as Little Mexico.
It's the last week of summer camp, and the kids here show no signs of slowing down. On this morning, the music has been blaring as they strut their stuff. Then they launch into making their own beats. And rapping about the park where the camp is located.
I love Pike Park, it's my favorite park. I love to go when you come and we have camp, that's another thing. And one of the activities is sing. Then we met some others in high school too. Little Mexico visit.
That's 7-year-old Dominique Gamble. The kids in the camp range from 5 to 12 years old, and a few of them live in the apartments next door, just off Harry Hines Boulevard. The area is now part of Uptown. It's where thousands of Mexicans settled in the early 20th century. Nicholas Gonzalez is an art student at SMU. He's working on a mural of Little Mexico with help from the camp kids.
Basically, I told them about this mural piece. I told them how important the park is and what it used to be and how it might disappear. You know, this is like the only thing we have left, Little Mexico.
Gonzalez had the kids slap their paint-covered hands on the canvas, leaving handprints all over. He took a blown-up map of what used to be Little Mexico and Pike Park and replicated the outline of it on the mural. He added landmarks like the gazebo, which sits next to the park. It's still a work in progress.
Right now, if you look at it, it's very colorful and basic line works, and there's a lot of movement to it. But that's what I'm trying to capture, more of a child innocence to it.
Gonzalez said he didn't want to paint faces or include writing on the mural. He wants it to remain somewhat mysterious. Janice Bergman Carton is associate professor of art history at Southern Methodist University and Gonzalez's mentor.
We've used a lot of visuals, a lot of historical photographs, historical maps. And most exciting for the kids, not surprisingly, were a series of conversations we were able to organize with elders of the Mexican-American community who grew up in Little Mexico and who grew up playing in Pike Park.
The idea for the mural and camp came up last fall during a Pike Park exhibit called Little Jerusalem to Little Mexico, 100 Years of Settlement. Bergman Carton said Dallas Parks and Recreation Director Willis Winters said the camp would be a step toward restoring and preserving the area. The kids have learned about the number of first-generation families, not just Mexican, but Swiss, German, Polish, and Jewish. And they learned that immigrants chose this area because it was so close to railroads and affordable housing.
And the idea is to make them feel like stakeholders, to enlist them in the aspiration to keep Pike Park not as it was, but as it could be and as they would like it to be.
12-year-old Cassandra Valdez says she's learned a lot.
It's kind of cool, and it's pretty interesting about how the history and how this place started up.
Valdez doesn't live in the area. Her dad is originally from Mexico. So was her mother's father.
Like my dad, he came to pick me up once and he saw the sign of Little Mexico, and he was actually shocked because like he lived in a little town in Mexico, and it was kind of like that.
Camper Isaiah Wells is 10 and lives in Cedar Hill. He says he's enjoyed getting his hands dirty and learning how to paint a mural, but he's also been captivated by the stories about the neighborhood.
It's been nice because I didn't know that Mexicans had built this. I thought just normal builders had built this.
Dallas Park officials want to renovate the building where the campers have set up shop. It used to be the place for boxing matches, dances, and other activities. They'd like to see it bustling again, and not just when summer camp is in session. For Fronteras, I'm Stella Chavez.
And now, this Fronteras is also history. We'll be back next week with more stories from the Southwest. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org. Alexis Yancey produced this broadcast. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Shelley Koffler from Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.